Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Joining us now is an award-winning Irish and British author. Her celebrated novel, Hamnet, is being made into a film starring Paul Mescal as William Shakespeare and Jessie Buckley as his wife. It's about the death of their son from the Black Death. It was an incredible novel. However, she's with us today to talk about her new children's book, When the Stammer Came to Stay. It's a must read for anyone who, you know, wants to understand what it's like to live with a speech impediment, but it's also a lovely story about sisters, I think. Maggie O'Farrell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you very much. When the Stammer Came to Stay, you never intended, did you, to write a very personal book like this, but it just happened.
That's the way it happens with fiction sometimes. Yeah. I set out, as you say, to write a book about two sisters, two very different sisters who share a bedroom, as I did with my younger sister. But actually, you know, I think fiction has a weird habit of playing a bit of a sleight of hand on you. And sometimes you think you're writing about one thing, and actually it turns out you're writing about something else entirely. And that's what happened with this book. I thought I was writing about sisters, but actually it turned out I was writing about a stammer, and specifically my experience of a stammer when I was a child.
So the story here is about a girl called Min. She's wild, she's a bit of fun, loves to chat, but then one day the words fail her.
That's right. Well, that's what happened to me when I was about, I think I was about six or seven, and I just developed a stammer. And it was strange because in that kind of logic you have in your head when you're a child, which is often a bit strange and skewed, I think I thought to myself for a while, you know, I can hear this repeated sound, but maybe no one else can. Maybe it's just inside my head.
Right.
But then, unfortunately, my classmates started taking the mickey out of me. And so I thought, oh, okay, other people can hear it. So I wanted to write actually about stammers because I feel I wanted to write something serious about someone having a stammer because I feel it too often, you know, in books and films and on TV where we're invited to laugh at people with stammers. You know, it's often played for comedy, and there's the idea that somebody can't speak fluently is played for laughs. And I obviously that makes me really cross. So I thought I'm going to write actually really what it's like to be a child who can't communicate verbally.
I mean, it's devastating for men. It must have been for you as well. Very limiting. The world starts to shrink for you.
Well, it does. You know, having a stammer is, I think for me anyway, has been the most defining thing about my life. You know, we are, as a species, we are wired for communication. We're wired for talking and chatting and telling stories. And if you can't do that, it affects your life in every single aspect. You know, it's impossible to go through a whole day without not having some kind of verbal interaction with somebody. So it does, it makes life very, very fraught. And of course, you know, at school, everybody, it takes the mick out of you. And as a child, I struggled with the repeated sound. And as an adolescent, of course, because everything's embarrassing when you're a teenager, least of all, you know, stammering when you speak. So I think I just kind of locked down on it and I just became very silent. And actually, when I was a teenager, it sort of, my stammer morphed into a kind of just a block, just being able to get any words out at all.
What things did you miss out on? Obviously, you loved English growing up.
Yes, that's right. So I didn't put my hand up much in class to answer. And at this point, I moved to Scotland when I was 13. And the hardest thing for me was, yes, being in English literature classes, because that was always my favourite subject. And if that we were reading, I don't know, Macbeth or, you know, a novel aloud, the teacher would pick us just to read the parts. And I was never able to put my hand up. And I was desperate to read Lady Macbeth or Banquo or whatever, but I couldn't do it because I was too worried about stammering.
You wanted to be Lady Macbeth?
Well, just any. I would settle for anyone, just a spear carrier. But I
just to do, yeah, just to do some Shakespeare. I noticed in the book you gave the stammer a capital T in the definite article and a capital S. It becomes very much a thing for you, as it does for Min. I mean, it becomes a grey vision. Can you explain that to us? How you came up with the idea?
Yeah, well, I think all stammerers have their own vision, their own relationship with their stammer. David Mitchell, the novelist, wrote a brilliant book called Black Swan Green. And he envisaged his stammer as hangman, you know, in the children's game where you have to. Yeah. And the hangman keeps crossing out letters that he can say, which I find fascinating.
Yes.
But when I was young, I always imagined my stammer as a kind of ghoul or a little kind of creature that sat on my shoulder and it would steal my words. And it's called a Dybbuk in the book. My husband's Jewish. And the Dybbuk is from a sort of Jewish folklore, and they're actually in real life absolutely terrifying. So we had to really tone it down for the children's.
I looked it up when I was going. Quite father. It's a dislocated soul, isn't it? That is.
Yeah, that's right.
You.
So I said, no, we've got to bring it right down. I don't want to be responsible for lots of nightmares. So it's a bit like a kind of misty gargoyle that sits on Min's shoulder and it eats her words. And that was just always the way I imagined my own stammer. It's a kind of a projection of it.
A beautifully illustrated in this story as well, we should say.
Well, I can't take any responsibility for that, Oliver. That was all my collaborator, my partner in crime, who's Daniela Jaglenka-Terrazzini. She's an absolute genius. You know, she's made it look so beautiful and so timeless, actually. There's something very... And she kind of... Her illustrations sit very interestingly on that kind of reality, sort of surreality axis, which I love.
They do. I love the fact that you do children's books and they sit very happily alongside your great literary works.
Well, I do really love it. It's a very different set of muscles that you have to use, I think, for writing for children. And the thing I do with them, which I don't do with my, I was going to say adult books, that sounds a bit wrong, like I'm writing 50 Shades of Grey, grown-up books, I'm going to say. but it's just that I actually read them aloud when I'm writing them. Because you have to hear it, you know, it's got to work as something to be read to someone. Mm. And the cadences of the sentence are very different. And it's very good. I have actually... In the writing of them, I do read them to my own children. And children are very, you know, direct editors in that if they don't like it, they'll just get up and walk away. So so you get very instant feedback from children, put it that way.
Interesting, actually, the When the Stammer Came to Stay. Is that a book that could be read aloud because it obviously features instances of stammering?
Yeah, I really designed the book to be read aloud to sort of younger children, say around 5, and then an older child, say 10 or 11, could possibly read it to themselves, depending on how they, you know, how literate that they are feeling. I think it's important that it has to work as something that can be read. And also, one of the things that I've learned actually from writing picture books with Daniela is that it's very important that I need to carve out spaces in the story for her to take the reins. So there are things that appear in the illustrations which don't appear in the words and vice versa. So a child listening can see things in the pictures that not necessarily they might be hearing.
Now, one of the worst things that happens to Min after the stammer arrives is that some people who may be considering themselves well-meaning, they try to finish her sentences for her. That's a horror for stammerers.
Yes, I would say if anyone's listening and they have a stammerer in their life, please don't try to finish their sentences. Please don't try and second guess what they're going to say or, you know, try and supply the words. The best thing I find anyway, and obviously every stammerer is different, is that if I start stammering, which I still do to this day, you know, I think you're never an ex-stammerer. You're always somebody who's just managing it into various degrees. The best thing that I find is if somebody just acknowledges it, as they say to me, I see you've got a stammer, please take your time. And to me, that's always like a kind of a key turning in a lock. And it's such a relief that somebody acknowledges it and just says to you, it's not a problem. I can, you know, I can wait. I can be patient. And then, of course, I can speak very fluently after that.
It's the simplest thing in the world. Somebody is struggling with a word. I can see you're a stammerer or you have a stammer. Take your time. It's as simple as that.
Please take your time. Yeah. It's funny. I mean, I spent so long trying to hide that I had a stammerer. You know, I think I got stuck in a kind of the mindset of my adolescence that I just had to hide it at all costs. And actually, I only had speech therapy when I was 40. And that was one of the things my speech therapist said to me. She said, so what? So what if people know? You just say to people, I've got a stammer. You know, you put it out there. And if they can't cope with it, that's their problem. It's not yours.
Simple as that. And you don't apologise for it is also an important.
Yes, she was very strict to me about that because she made me practice saying, I have a stammer. And I, every time I said it, I said, I'm sorry, I have a stammer. And she said, no, you're not allowed to apologise. You just say it. No apologies here.
Has science discovered yet why people stammer?
No, I think it's still quite mysterious. And people think it might be neurological. Some people, I think, get a conditioned stammer. You know, you get some kind of fright or you're under some kind of stress. There is a recent research which suggests it's linked to dyslexia. I myself am not dyslexic, but I have heard that. It is quite mysterious. No one really quite knows. And they know it's much more common in boys and men than it is in women. About 8% of children have a stammer. only about 1% of adults. So it is still shrouded in mystery. But I think the truth of it is that, you know, that we're all very different, you know, yeah. We are as people and humans, and it's a very complex thing.
You've accepted the stammer now. And would you have become a writer if you didn't have it?
Well, I think that's something else that I realised. You know, I think my stammer is, obviously, for years, I absolutely hated it. It felt like my enemy, and it felt like something that was trying to, you know, crush the life out of me in some ways. But now, looking back on it now, as a, whatever I am, 52, I can see that I don't think I would have been a writer unless I had also had a stammer. You know, I think if you're a stammerer as a young child, you become incredibly hypersensitive to language and grammar and meaning at a really, really young age, because any stammerer in any conversation is inside their head, you know, redrafting and editing and thinking about the ways to say things. You know, you're looking ahead in a conversation, thinking about what you might be expected to say next. And if that thing starts with a word or a sound that's a problem for you, you're editing yourself and you're thinking, well, I can flip that clause around. I can change a different word. I can think of a synonym. So you're operating on an entirely different level to anyone else who's talking.
Well, that's an extraordinary insight into the machine ticking in someone's head, that you have to give such careful thought to the next word, the next sentence, in the hope that it'll arrive out.
Yeah. Also, you can't overestimate what a joy it is to be able to write and your words just flow.
It has definitely helped.
It's like nothing else.
Yeah. It has certainly worked for you because you've written quite a lot of novels. And I look back here, 2000, I think, is the first one you put out. So you've been doing it since a young woman. But we have to talk about Hamnet, because that's the one that really, really lands for you, doesn't it?
Well, it's very exciting. Yes, the film of Hamnet it's just finished filming. Wow. And it's, as you said, Jesse Buckley is Agnes and Paul Mescal is Shakespeare. So it's an absolute, I mean, I can't even say it's a dream cast, because I didn't even really think it would ever possibly happen. But yeah, I can say that the two of them are absolutely spectacular. They just light up every single scene they're in. And I just can't wait for everybody else to see it.
When will we see it?
I don't know. This bit is not my job. I co-wrote the script and I was on set quite a lot.
That's part of your job.
But now it's in the editing suite. But now it's in the editing suite, and that's the director Chloe Dowd's job. So I'm just happy to hand it over to her, to the experts.
It was shot in Wales, but you hung out in the set to watch things. I mean, that must be a surreal moment to have something that came from your brain.
It is very odd. It was a kind of splitting in two moment, because part of me was just very excited about being on a film set, because that's not something I've ever experienced before. And also meeting, you know, people like Paul and Jesse and all the rest of the cast, which is fantastic. And that was all, you know, seeing all the costumes being made and the makeup and the props and everything. It was a thrilling day. But then, of course, you know, I'd be watching on the monitor and someone would say something and then I'd think, oh, I wrote that. That's very weird. So it was a very, very strange experience. But you know, absolutely, it was fantastic.
A once in a lifetime. Allow yourself the thrill, for sure. We'll be watching this, of course, with great interest in Ireland, because it's such a British hero, William Shakespeare, and we've got these Irish talents there. This is kind of like a merging of all your identities as well, isn't it?
It is. I know what you mean. I mean, I always thought it should be Paul Mescal. I always thought he would make the absolute perfect Shakespeare, because he has that kind of, he has both those elements of Shakespeare. You know, he can do the absolute heart-wrenching tragedy, but he's also a very good comedian in a sense as well. And I think, you know, you had to have someone who could do both of those aspects of Shakespeare. And I think he's absolutely perfect.
You're from Derry. What do you say nowadays? Are you British? Are you Irish? Do people ask you, expect you to put yourself in a box?
Well, it's funny. I mean, yeah, I was born in Derry, but we moved to the UK shortly afterwards. You know, I was born in Derry in 72, which was not, which is not the high point of that time. No. So it was a fraught time. And I think when my dad was offered a job in Britain, I think he took it to get us out of there. I don't think he ever thought we'd be gone for good. And I don't know. It's funny, when I'm in Britain, I'm considered Irish. When I'm in Ireland, I feel very British, obviously, because of my accent. So I'm confused. But I would say that I'm very proud of my Irish passport and I'm clinging to it ever tighter, especially since Brexit.
You're very aware of your English accent when you're here. Explain that to me now.
Well, I suppose it's just a feeling that it's very hard to decide. You know, I think if you don't grow up in the place where you are born, as I did, you always have this kind of ghost self. You know, you always imagine you always have that thought, you know, what would have happened if we'd stayed? Who would I have been? There's that other person. If I'd had an accent that matched my passport or my name, for example, you know, what would that have been like? But of course, you know, you never know. But there is that sense of kind of othering in a way, I think.
I know some English people who have never lived in Ireland and they consider themselves extremely Irish, despite their accents. And, you know, they are Irish because culturally they celebrated probably more than we do here.
Mm, I think that's true. I mean, obviously, there's a vast Irish diaspora all over the world. You know, I've met people in America and Australia who say they're Irish and they've got one, you know, great grandparent. You know, but yeah. I don't have a problem with that. I think, why not? You know, come one, come all, really. But I think it's a complicated thing. And certainly, you know, having our surname in Britain in the 70s and 80s was not an easy thing. You know, there was an awful lot of... It was a kind of very strong element of anti-Irish feeling, and relations between the two countries were very fraught at that time. I think it's improved now. I wish I could say that it's because some people are less racist, but I'm not sure that's true. I think just a different community is receiving that sort of negativity. Yes. But certainly it's you know, there's a very long and very complicated history between these two countries, and I'm very aware of that. I think one of the interesting thing that I find very interesting is that there are in America there's a very accepted phrase, you know, you talk about Irish Americans, and it's the same in Australia. There is no equivalent phrase ever used in Britain. No one ever says Irish British or British Irish, which
it
I think is very significant.
Off. Yeah, it is significant,
yeah,
isn't
semantically,
it?
Semantically, it's a very interesting lack.
You could be the first, Maggie. British Irish, Irish British.
That's a really hard thing for a stammer to say all the way. There's a lot of complicated sounds in there.
It's the B, that's the problem. What about your parents and their Irishness? Because your dad felt he had to leave. Did he, does he continue to look back at Ireland, or did he quite happily embrace the Britishness?
Very much so. My dad is very, very, I mean, he will only read Irish newspapers. I think he listens. He's probably listening to this right now. He only reads Irish. He sees it as a personal reflection. If there's a kind of if the GAA, I think it's, I can't remember which. I think it's probably Leinster or Dublin that he supports. If, you know, there's some kind of sporting triumph in the Olympics, he gets incredibly excited if Ireland wins.
Well,
a gold medal.
Well, a good summer, yeah.
You know, it's he did. I got lots of very excited phone calls about that. So yes, he's very much still connected.
Is that a good thing to be still looking back at the kind of past identity rather than the new place, which has become your home?
I think it is. I think it's very important to a lot of people for their identity as to who they are. And I don't think it's necessarily looking back. I think it's just a sort of self-defining thing. And, you know, why not? Why not be proud when Ireland wins a gold medal? I am.
You're very welcome to join us all the time, Maggie. We'll be claiming you forever now. I mean, these rows go
on.
Well,
that makes me feel very happy.
Absolutely. Another one of your writings was a kind of a memoir, wasn't it? A very unusual memoir, an account of the many ways that you nearly died.
Yeah.
And there are quite a few, and they are astonishing. First of all, the decision to write that memoir, what were you thinking at the time?
Well, you know, I never thought I would write a memoir. In fact, my husband used to make a joke about it. And I always think, you know, and I still feel very wedded to fiction and novels, but, you know, sometimes I feel that you don't always choose the books choose you, really. And what happened was I was actually planning to write Hamlet, and I was a bit nervous about writing a novel about Shakespeare because I did think, you know, who does that? But actually what started happening is that I was writing these longer autobiographical pieces about the times I nearly died. And after a while, I did think, oh no, I think this might be a memoir. So I was quite nervous, but you know, it seemed to me that actually, you know, the lens of the near death experience is a very interesting one through which to look at life, because I think it's something we've all experienced. I think there's a universality to it, and you know, all of us have had, you know, come close to death. You know, sometimes more dramatically than others. It just seemed to me a very interesting way to sort of examine a life going through all those times that you nearly lost that life. And also, it was very important to me to be able to write a memoir that was honest, but at the same time, not a big tax on my friends and family. You know, so sometimes you read memoirs and, you know, I'm absolutely gobsmacked by the way the writer will be exposing their friends and their family. And I just think afterwards, you know, as I close it, I think, well, do you have any friends left? You know, is anyone still talking to you? I wanted to be able to write something that, you know, I was being honest with my reader, but also protecting the people around me, because, you know, they may not want to be written about at all. They have no right of reply.
And there are 17 experiences that brought you close to death. Three near drownings, a lorry that passed a fraction of a millimetre from your head. These were very traumatic incidents, each one of these. The mismanaged labour for the birth of your child was a particularly horrific one.
Mm.
A plane journey that saw passengers.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, go on.
Well, the NHS is not in great shape. I mean, that was a while ago. That child is now 21 and has a job in an office and wears a tie, which I find quite shocking. But I don't know if the NHS has improved since then. I unfortunately suspect not.
Dear, oh dear. Did you learn things each time it happened? Did you start to wonder, are you cursed? Did you have bad luck?
No, actually, quite the opposite. I think I've always felt that, you know, I was very ill as a child. I nearly died when I was 8. I had viral encephalitis, which affected my cerebellum and my movement. So I spent a long time in bed or in a wheelchair. But actually, after that, I didn't feel unlucky. Actually, I felt totally the opposite. I felt incredibly lucky that, first of all, I didn't die. And second of all, I was able to walk again, because at the time they didn't think I would. And that's all down to physiotherapists who helped me. I lay all that entirely at their door, because they kind of believed in me and made sure that I did my exercises and was strong enough to walk again. So, but actually, I feel so lucky. You know, not only did I not die, I'm able to live an independent and ambulatory life. So, and I think that was always the experience that I came out of whenever I had one of these experiences that was, you know, that I could have lost my life, but I didn't. So what am I going to do with the rest of my life, which feels like a gift? You know, how am I going to make the absolute most of it that I can?
When you're sick as a child, you have an encounter with a man whose name, I gather, you don't like saying. So I'll do it if you don't mind, just to let people know what we're talking about.
That's fine.
That's Jimmy Savile. You were a child in hospital.
Yeah. I was a child in hospital in Wales, and I woke up one day and he was sitting by my bed, and he was doing one of his hospital visits, which he did. But at the time, I was under 24-hour watch, and I had a nurse with me at all times, because they thought the kind of paralysis that was affecting me physically, they were worried was going to start affecting my involuntary processes like breathing and my heart. So I had someone with me all the time. And I still think that, I mean, I don't know, who knows? And I don't want to diminish the experiences of people who were victimized by him, but I feel very beholden to that woman who stayed in my room. Yes. Even when he asked her to leave, she stayed.
He gave you a book, which you discovered many years later.
Yeah, he gave me a book about how to make Halloween costumes, which even a few years ago, when my children were younger, I was looking through boxes of my old books, and I found it with his signature in it. But I there was no way I was going to give it to my children, so I burnt it. And I've never, ever in my whole life destroyed a book before, but I just didn't want it in the world. I didn't want it out there. I certainly didn't want my children to have anything to do with it.
Do you know what? That's the most Irish thing that you've discussed, because a pagan ritual definitely confirms that you were one of us. But what a good way to put an end to that.
Well, I didn't want it to exist anymore, and I didn't want anyone else to find it by accident. And yeah, I just thought that this has to not be in the world anymore. It has to go.
Well, you've come through it all, Maggie O'Farrell. Thank you very much. And
that's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for giving us all these joyful writings that have come out of your head, and have come out of the stammer as well. When the Stammer Came to Stay is published by Walker Books. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much, Oliver.
Thanks so much, Maggie. Maggie O'Farrell there.